I want people to be making the ethical argument for free trade as the supreme instrument of poverty alleviation, of conflict resolution, and of social justice.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Daniel Hannan. He's a member of the European Parliament for the time being, and he was also one of the people behind the Brexit, one of the heads of Vote Leave. Daniel, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
So what is going on with Brexit now? England has, you know, they passed a referendum, we're out, but nothing quite has moved on since then.
It's a two-year process until Brexit formally takes effect. And we're going to use those 2 years to try and scope the kind of trade deals that we can have in the rest of the world. I mean, the EU, although it's an internal market, is actually a fairly protectionist body vis-a-vis non-European countries.
Even though it's the single largest economic trading zone, they did not create any agreements with outside entities.
They have some, generally with countries that are either in the European area or are usually French former territories in North Africa. But they don't have the big trade deals, China, India, United States, you know, Indonesia, Brazil, none of those. And so this is our opportunity. If we can get this right, you know, we voted to leave a protectionist customs union. We now have a chance to be a more deregulated, more global, more free trading country. And if we get this right, it can benefit everybody. It can be the thing that lifts the world back into a more open trading system, because frankly, you're not going to get that from Brussels, and I don't think there's any great enthusiasm for it now in the White House. So somebody has got to be making the case for freer trade and unrestricted commerce.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States context, both Democrats and Republicans seem to be pretty protectionist these days.
So and it's nice a reaction, to, yeah. I think, to the it's a delayed reaction to the financial crisis. You know, people have drawn exactly the wrong conclusion, but in a way, understandably, they say the system was rigged, the big corporates and multinationals are profiting. Maybe we should be kind of looking to ourselves more, which of course is exactly the opposite, right? I want people to be making the ethical argument for free trade as the supreme instrument of poverty alleviation, of conflict resolution, and of social justice.
And that's because when you trade, you gain from both sides gain if it's done freely.
It's moral, but also, what else has done so much to lift our species to the current levels of health and happiness? I mean, in 1990, 38% of human beings were living in extreme poverty, that is, on a dollar a day or less. And now that figure is 8%. Why? Because previously closed African and Asian countries have joined the nexus of global trade. The biggest paradox of our age is that these idealistic young people who go on Occupy sit-ins or protest G20 meetings or whatever have somehow got it into their heads that by opposing free trade, they're standing up for the poor against the multinationals. Right. When in fact, they're doing exactly the opposite. It's the multinationals that thrive on the distortions and the tariffs and the quotas, and it's the poor who will benefit most from their removal.
Talk in an American context, the way the Brexit vote gets discussed, you know, there's some of this, and certainly you're the spokesman for that, and then it is usually discussed in a way that is related to the Trump phenomenon here, and we'll talk about the parallels between Brexit and Trump in a bit, but that it's really about nativism, it's about racism, it's about xenophobia, it's about a fear, a traditional historic fear of England being overrun as an island nation by others.
Yes.
Where is that wrong in the Brexit?
It's wrong on every level. I mean, even down to it being traditional and historic. I mean, you won't find a much more open country historically, you know, and both commercially and culturally. You know, I've learned in politics that nobody ever really listens to or reads anything by the other side. All they do is they read their friend's report of what the other side is supposed to have said, right? And if we really had fought a nativist and protectionist campaign, we wouldn't have got into double figures, let alone winning. You know, you win because you carry people with a sense of optimism and vision. There is more of a consensus for free markets in Britain than probably in any other large economy in the world. No one said we should cut ourselves off from trade with our European friends. Nor does anyone, by the way, want to stop being engaged with allies on every continent. But the reality is the European Union is collapsing. It's collapsing as a share of world trade. It's a 1950s hangover. It's dirigiste. It's top down. We can do better raising our eyes to
but
more distant
horizons.
What
about the movement of people? Because this is, you know, in Ireland they talk about Polish people or, you know, Slovakians flooding the market and things like that.
Sure.
Isn't that, I mean, what was the role of the free movement of workers within the labor force of the EU?
Of course, there was some concern about that. But it's important that, well, you know, it's one of those things where you can swap anecdotes or you can look at the data. Mm-hmm. All of the polls were very clear that the biggest issue, by far the biggest issue, was democracy or sovereignty or however you want it, taking your own decisions. Immigration was a very distant second. And not everyone citing immigration as their top concern wanted a complete... In fact, I don't think anyone wanted a complete end to immigration. People wanted a sense of some control, and I think that's actually a perfectly legitimate thing.
So what would a controlled immigration flow or worker flow look like compared to the openness of the EU, which from a classical liberal perspective, particularly in Europe, barely out of, you know, two world wars, is kind of amazing, really.
Sure. So, I mean, there is a consensus behind certain kinds of immigration being good. 88% of people want qualified and skilled workers from the EU to continue to come to the UK. 84% of people want all EU nationals currently in the UK, skilled or unskilled, to be allowed to stay. But there were some very contentious cases. For example, there was a hate preacher called Abu Hamza, an Islamist hate preacher, who was eventually deported. His daughter-in-law was found guilty of a criminal offence, incarcerated, and then sentenced to deportation. And overturned the deportation order in the European Court, even though she was a Jordanian national, because her son had been born in the UK and this was held to violate his rights as a European citizen.
To have his mother raise him, something like that.
The court's judgment said she is the sole carer. Mm-hmm. I think the implication is that we, the taxpayer, are the sole breadwinner,
right,
as happens in these cases. Now, I think people very reasonably, perfectly legitimately said, hang on, for an immigration policy to work, you have to be able to distinguish between, you know, the person who's coming to be a professor or a surgeon or whatever, and someone who is here living on benefits and preaching a doctrine that is hostile to the whole Western order. If we're not able to determine who we admit and whom we keep out, then we're in no sense a democracy.
Talk a bit about also one of the main talking points of Brexit was, okay, these unelected bureaucrats were dictating, you know, in faraway capitals, Brussels, whatever, were dictating laws. How is that right? Because isn't it also the case that you were elected to represent England or Britain? Mm. You go there, you pass a bunch of laws, and then they come back. So is it that clear?
So we have, you know, a 9% or 12% share over the laws, and that would be fine if we felt a community of identity, if we felt that we were part of the same people, in the same way that, you know, my constituency, the people in Hampshire or Surrey, accept the UK. But it does depend on having that affinity. People sometimes say, oh, well, but, you know, Idaho accepts the jurisdiction of the federal authorities. Yeah, okay.
It's a bad choice, we get the
right
idea.
But it's a bad choice. Real parallel here would be if I were to say you should have a Pan-American Union with a Pan-American Parliament in Havana that would have supremacy over your laws, with a Pan-American Central a Supreme Court in Caracas that would be able to strike down laws of Congress. Let's throw in a Pan-American Central Bank in Buenos Aires that administers your new currency, the Pan-American Peso. That would be the fair parallel.
Right.
And, of course, you know how that would be received. People would tell me to buzz off or they might use a stronger word than buzz.
So do you see you talk about the collapse of the EU or the failure, and it's clear that, you know, with Britain leaving, but other countries are talking about it, there's economic difficulties. And you called it a hangover from the 1950s, from the common market days. Does it represent, it was rather than being a new beginning for Europe, it's the last gasp of that old kind of 19th, 20th century centralized control model?
I think it's a very good way of putting it. Yeah,
everything in our lives is becoming more dispersed, more decentralized.
Correct.
And Europe will again.
Correct. I think the U.S., in one sense, was incredibly lucky in the timing of its foundation. The Constitution was drawn up at the moment when there was the maximum emphasis in Western thought on the liberty of the individual and constraints on state power. Ask the question whether the Bill of Rights would get through Congress today.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, the European Union is also a child of its time. It was born at a time when there was a huge belief in the power of beneficent government, and when the whole model was kind of was top down and dirigiste. So built into the foundations of the EU are a collectivist agricultural system, common external tariffs, industrial policy, and indeed government by, as you said, unelected people, because it was thought that democracy was a bit dangerous. People would get the wrong ideas.
And it
so
was
on.
Inefficient.
Right, so you should have these wise technocrats who were disinterested and immune to public opinion. As you say, the world has moved on.
Now, is the alternative, though, and particularly in Europe, and you see this these kinds of flashpoints happening, certainly during the early years of the EU in the 90s and whatnot, of, it's either Europe is either unified or it's balkanized and people start shooting at each other again. Are those the only two options?
There's a really good extant third option, which is the European Free Trade Association. The European Free Trade Association is a classical free trade area. It's much more like NAFTA than like the European Union. That is, it doesn't really busy itself with behind border issues. It sets common standards when you're trading rather than when you're not. And it's based on mutual recognition of products rather than standardized rules. Mm-hmm. Pretty good model, right?
Yeah.
And of course, it has no aspirations to political union. Now, I hope that Britain will have that kind of relationship with other countries in Europe, based in a continuing common market, but without an external tariff. So we'll be able to sign a free trade agreement with you, with Canada, and so on. There will be some countries in Europe that, for whatever historical reasons, are still wedded to the ideal of federalization, centralization. Great. Let them. I mean, isn't the ideal outcome from here that you try and create a pan-continental market that stretches from, Iceland to Turkey, Armenia, likely but effectively regulated common market open to the rest of the world, encompassing, 40, 45 countries, states and territories. Mm-hmm. And then within that, sure, have 20, 25 countries that want their single currency, their single president, their single foreign policy. Good luck to them. Doesn't that let everybody get on better?
Right.
The peripheral countries get the common market, which is what they came for. The core countries can push ahead.
How does the Brexit complicate something like NATO or the military alliances throughout Western Europe or the developed world? Because it seems that while there's a groundswell of support for Brexit, there's also more of a bigger need for a unified European defense against Russia or whatever.
As a matter of fact, during the campaign, a decision was made to deploy UK personnel to the defense of Poland and Estonia. And nobody criticized that decision. Mm. Nobody on either side tried to press it into the referendum argument or make a big issue out of why are our guys defending a faraway country. There was a consensus that this was the right thing to do. Similarly, during the campaign, we took a decision to deploy naval resources to help with the migration crisis in the Mediterranean, and nobody criticized it. So Britain has not voted for disengagement. Those things are almost uniformly supported, and our commitment to NATO remains. I think that the critics of NATO in the US have one perfectly good point, which is that the burden has to be fairly shared.
Right.
The US has a $20 trillion debt nearly, and it has to pick and choose what its overseas commitments are going to be. And it does seem unfair to expect the US to bear the burden of European defense when all it gets back are insults and sarcastic comments. So I think that's a good argument to be having.
Well, speaking of Trump, who made a similar argument, what are the parallels between the dynamics behind Brexit and the election of Donald Trump here, if there are any? I mean, it's presumed that, Trump himself and Nigel Farage has said there's commonality. Farage,
right.
I guess, even campaigned for him a bit.
So we've said that there is this big difference. A big part of Trump's shtick, insofar as I understand it, was we don't want a free trade agreement with China.
Right.
A huge part of our campaign was
TPP
we do.
As right. well, because right. he's...
with TPP, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But a huge part of ours was we do want a trade agreement with China. The EU won't let us have one. We're going to be... So we can overdo this. What I think the two phenomena did have in common, I suppose inescapably, was a sense of anger against what was seen to be a failing political elite. And I think that sense of anger has really been mounting ever since the crash and the bailouts. I think there's been a widespread sense on both sides of the Atlantic that the response to the financial crisis, to the credit crunch, was to penalize low and medium income families in order to rescue some very wealthy bankers and bondholders from the consequences of their own error. And in a way, Trump and Sanders and a number of the protest parties in Europe are all kind of delayed responses to what happened in 2008-2009. That said, you know, the way that you address people's concerns is not simply by reflecting their anger back at them or amplifying their sense of grievance. The way you address their concerns is to tackle the problem of certain groups being left behind. And I think one very obvious way you can do that is to change the monetary policy that your central, your Fed and our Bank of England and the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan have all been doing, which is this constant splurge of quantitative easing, which has led to an asset price inflation, which has indeed penalized the unskilled workers. And that's something very easily fixed and would I think, go a long way to addressing people's sense of unfairness.
What is there, do you think that this is a, you know, we've reached a new part of history, and there's economists in the U.S. who talk about this, well, welcome to 2% annual growth if we're lucky. The years of 3%, 4%, 5% are over, so that we really need to manage the scant resources that we have. Mm. Is that myopic?
Or I think so. You know, we thought like that in the 70s in Britain.
Yeah, that it was over.
It was over. The phrase was managed decline. It's a question of how in how civilized a way can we do this, you know? And there were apparently rational reasons for thinking that. You know, we had constant strikes. We had double-digit inflation.
The Beatles had broken up.
Right.
I mean, nothing was going right.
Prices and incomes policies. I mean, a conservative government passing laws on what you were allowed to earn and what you were allowed to set your prices at. It was a completely reasonable thing to think we're finished. But, of course, we didn't realize then that we were on the verge of a great national renaissance under Margaret Thatcher. So I'm very optimistic about this country and about the long-term future of it. I think the individualistic and dispersed political and legal institutions of the US fit it very, very well for prosperity in this century. And I see a great future where there'll be driverless cars and advances in biotech and 3D printing and all sorts of things based on innovation, because the innovators are always several steps ahead of regulators.
Right.
They're always cleverer.
One hopes. Talk a bit about, both in Europe as well as in the United States, there is a fear that with a kind of populist uprising against established powers, which I think we would agree is a good thing, nativist sentiments, racialist sentiments come in. And we already see, I mean, on the left, people hold on to racial categories, ethnic categories, gender categories, very much so. They don't want to let those go. And on the right, you're seeing that. In the United States, the alt-right talks about a white nationalism that really hasn't been heard from since the late 60s or early 70s in the United States. Is that a concern for you, either in England or in the U.S. or across the developed world, where it seems like you know, things are breaking down along racial, ethnic lines in a way that's troubling?
I'm not sure how true that is. Mm-hmm. It's natural to become alarmed about people saying extreme things, even if their numbers are tiny.
Right.
If you spend your life on Twitter, you think the alt-right is a very big deal. But how many times do you hear any normal person raising it in the real world rather than virtually, right? Funnily enough, I just had a meeting with the behavioral psychologist Jonathan Haidt, brilliant writer, who I think his work is at the most, it's the most important cutting edge work being done in terms of understanding what drives our political sympathies. And his point was that actually most of this sentiment is not about race or categorization by, you know, ethnicity, gender, and so on, but is about a sense of being insulted, having your values traduced, in other words, being called a racist all the time, and that's created a backlash from people who are not in any sense racist. Now, of course, there is a minority of racist numbskulls in your country, in mine, and in every other. But I think we should keep a sense of proportion. The backlash is not really driven by the people who have jumped onto it. It's driven by a sense that elites used a cronyist and corporatist system to enrich themselves at public expense, and then B, that having done that, they turned around and spat on the values of the people who'd bailed them out.
Right. For Trump, and you've written recently in the Washington Examiner, not that you are warming up to Trump, but that you're de-thawing towards him.
Yeah.
What are the early indicators that will make you think, okay, this guy is heading in the right direction, or now this, we got to, you know, there's a real problem here?
Well, I guess that by the time people watch this video, they'll have a better idea of what the administration is
looks
made
like.
Up of than as I'm talking to you. But obviously that's going to be the first early sign from here. And the speculation I do find quite encouraging, actually. I think there's some really good names out there. I was never that worried about... I think some of the hysteria is not just sort of self-indulgent and solipsistic. It kind of totally misses the point about the American Constitution. Your founders had someone very like Donald Trump in mind when they designed all these checks and balances. The capacity
and
of
Hillary Clinton as well.
And like Hillary Clinton, exactly. Yeah. Even the most Caligulan president is constrained. My guess is that there is basically a kind of anti-Trump majority in both houses now. There were lots of Republicans elected who didn't really hide their views of him. And that provides a constraint. And I think maybe I'm wrong. We'll see how he works out. But I mean, he is somebody who at least understands about deal making and understands about when a deal can't be done and how you should then make the best of it.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We've been talking with Daniel Hannan. He is a member of the European Parliament, and he was one of the main people behind Brexit, co-founder of the Vote Leave group. Daniel, thanks for talking
to us. Thank you so much.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.